What a joyful noise from pianist Murray Pariah and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. That was the Keyboard Concerto No. 6 by Johann Sebastian Bach. Pariah's latest CD is the Solo Partitas for Keyboard by Bach, and he is getting great reviews for that.
This is WHFR Dearborn at Henry Ford Community College. Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to this beautiful classical programming. If you'd like to try something a little bit different, maybe some classic radio from years gone by, then we suggest you check out the WHFR presentation every Monday evening, 11 p.m. until the midnight hour. It's a show that we call Old Time Radio Mysteries. That's right, it's a blast from the spooky past of radio, the golden age of those classic radio dramas, things like The Inner Sanctum, The Weird Circle, The Mysterious Traveler, Suspense, and so much more. It's 1 hour of great classic old-time radio, Monday evenings 11 until midnight. Check it out if you dare. And thanks so much for your support during WHFR's recent pledge drive, Radiothon 2008, our annual opportunity to have you make a donation to us, a tax-deductible donation. So thanks for your support.
They called it the
Affair.
The
following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is UFO investigator, lecturer, and author Peter Robbins. Mr. Robbins has lectured on the UFO topic at numerous symposia and colleges around the world. And Robbins has also appeared as a guest on the and consultant to numerous documentaries, television, and radio shows here and abroad. He is co-author with UFO witness Larry Warren of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up, and investigation. And we are honored to have him with us on the show today. Hello, Mr. Robbins.
Hi, David. Please call me Peter.
Peter, okay. I will do so. And I am Dave, by the way.
Okay.
Now, you are co-author with Larry Warren. I know Larry Warren has also showed up on many documentaries telling about the Rendlesham Forest case, as well as... he is, or was at least, the Disclosure Project member.
That's correct in both cases.
He is still a Disclosure Project member, and they're begging for open congressional hearings since 2001 at least.
Yeah, I'd have to characterize, I don't know if he's a member per se, but he did appear as a witness in that absolutely historic symposium that they sponsored at the Washington Press Club that year.
Right. Yes, I know. Was May 9th, 2001, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And I know your the book, Left at Eastgate, is quite a complex book. I've read it, and it's excellently written.
Thank you.
And but it's quite involved. But could you give our listeners a encapsulated version of the incident?
I'll try. The incident itself is actually a composite of a number of events that happened in Suffolk, England. That's about 100 or so miles northeast of London, a very highly militarized, although a rural area. It happened over the course of three consecutive nights in December 1980, right between Christmas and New Year's. All of the key witnesses are American Air Force personnel who were stationed there at the time. On the first night, a series of UFO incursions occurred above RAF Bentwaters, the base that my co-author was stationed on at the time, and its sister base about 6 miles away, RAF Woodbridge. UFOs were seen to be coming in over the Rendlesham Forest, which surrounds and enjoins the bases, as well as the bases themselves. Multiple witnesses, including the deputy base commander, have attested to the fact that these UFOs shine down, I guess now what would look like kind of industrial lasers, shining these beams to the ground, including even in the nuclear weapons storage area. It was observed by men on the ground. It was absolutely recorded on radar and created an extra tension on the bases that they did not need. The backdrop of this was the bases were on red alert, as were other bases in the United Kingdom and NATO bases all over Europe. Due to the Soviet concerns about Lech Wałęsa's pro-democracy movement coming out of the Gdansk shipyards in Poland. And we were very close to war with the Soviets at the time, although that was not anything that was known to the public. Mm. On the second night again, UFOs cruised in over the area, seemingly in organized patterns at times. Colonel Halt this time and a number of men that he was with observed them coming through the woods, shooting down these beams to the ground very close to their position. We have definite documented incidences where they literally came through the forest canopy, ripping up branches and tearing up bark where they touched some of the vegetation, came down into and around the forest, leaving impressions in the ground. These impressions registered more than 10 times the normal background beta and gamma radiation readings. And again, the base was on a very high state of alert. I should also say that more dramatic on the first night was that four American Air Force police officers observed a light go down in the forest and radioed into command control for permission to investigate what had happened there. It did not have the earmarks of a crash. There was not a flash of light or a thump or a sound or a fire, but it had to be investigated in any case. They went out into the woods, and as you may be familiar with, it's such a well-documented account, came upon an object about 7 feet on each side, an equilateral triangle with the surface something like black glass, literally coasting at about chest height very quietly through the woods. Surrounded it, one sergeant drew his weapon on it, another got close enough to make out what I can only describe as hieroglyphic, some kind of non-recognizable writing. Their radio communications failed, and in fact one of the men went missing and was missing for quite a number of days later. Whether or not he was literally in shock and kind of hiding out in the forest or was abducted, we do not know.
Well, the person who was who disappeared, was that Larry Warren or someone else?
Oh, no, Larry was involved, excuse me, on the third night. This was the first night.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. On the third night, pretty much the most dramatic thing, UFOs again came in over the Twin Base complex. Larry had been on a two-day pass, had not been aware of this. It was really clamped down around. It was not the source of a lot of joking or anything. This was considered very serious. He was on guard duty that night at a very remote perimeter post, normally not manned, but manned in this case because of the concern of, conflict with the Soviets. He heard other men on his Motorola radio talking about UFOs they were seeing low on the horizon several miles down. A sergeant came on and told them to be quiet about this. Not long after, he was radioed that he would be picked up shortly by a military vehicle to close down his post, that he would have another assignment. Shortly thereafter, a vehicle did come, and it picked him up. He was brought, along with many other men and vehicles, to the base motor pool, where these trucks hooked up lightalls. Lightalls are kind of the military equivalent of the big civilian Klieg lights we associate with Hollywood premieres. These ones were gas-operated. The tanks were all topped off, and sometime after midnight, a caravan, a military caravan, rolled off the base into the English countryside with loaded weapons in violation of our treaty with the United Kingdom. They were taken 5 or 6 miles away to an area about a mile from the perimeter of RAF Woodbridge, brought up a logging road, told to disembark. They were then disarmed, broken into three-man groups. Each group was given a Motorola radio, and they were told to head that direction into the woods to, quote-unquote, investigate a disturbance. After a certain amount of walking through the woods, all felt things had gotten very strange. There was a tremendous static electricity charge in the air. The most dramatic example I can give of it was these men were, they wore berets. They didn't wear helmets, and these are primarily young kids. We remember those fabulous healthy heads of hair we had at 18, 19, 20 years old.
Oh, yes.
In some cases, guys with longer hair, the hair was starting to push their berets off their heads. Larry and his unit came upon a comrade who was basically broken down and sobbing, continued on into a farmer's field marked on all local maps as Capel Green. In the field, about 150 feet in or so, was a ground fog. Now, you've only to see a Sherlock Holmes movie or any BBC production to know that ground fogs are fairly common in Great Britain, but not like this. This one was perfectly round. It was standing about a foot off the ground, and it was self-illuminated. There was no ambient light. It was a moonless night. It's a rural area. Lightalls were brought into the field, and absolutely every single one of them failed to work. Again, radio communications, flashlights were dodgy. The men, quite a few dozen of them, were ordered to surround this ground fog. They did. They held their position. And after a while, all observed a small red light coming in slowly and very high from the direction of the North Sea. If you have a map of England and you find this area of Suffolk, the nearest town is Woodbridge, you'll see it's only about 6 miles from the coast. And they watched as the light literally came in, not just over their area, but over the field, and descended and came in over this ground fog, and then with magnesium-like brightness exploded without a sound. We have documented through Air Force medical records and my co-author's experience that at that moment the retinas of his eyes were burned. I can deduce that the eyes of other men were burned as well. And it took several seconds for Larry's eyes, and I'm sure the others' eyes, to acclimatize to what was happening. It would be the equivalent of having, I imagine, hundreds of flashbulbs go off in your face. You're temporarily blinded. And it was obvious to all that there was now a thing sitting in the ground fog, a, for lack of a more descriptive phrase, a fully articulated machine sitting on some kind of landing apparatus. It was of good size. It had a red glow at the top and kind of cobalt blue at the bottom. Several of the men ran off reflexively in fear into the woods. Most of them stood their ground and continued to do so. As the time started to pass, Larry and the man next to him, whose statement is included along with many, many others in Left at Eastgate, his name was Sergeant Adrian Bastinza, observed a glow on the far side of the craft and watched as it slowly started to move, and then finally turned the corner and came around so that they could see it. I should stress here, they were very close to this thing, Dave. They were no more than 20 feet away from it. And as the glow started to recede, they could make out three distinct shapes in the glow. Those shapes were beings, not human beings, but some kind of beings, you know, arms, leg, head, torso, and they were not the archetypical grays that we see in science fiction. They were stockier. They seemed to be in some kind of one-piece garments, and to just add a little more drama to it, they were about a foot off the ground and somewhat translucent. The event continued on. Again, these men were unarmed, and a peaceful standoff incurred into the night. At some point in the night, the wing commander, Gordon Williams, who retired several years later as a two-star general, entered this circle and faced off with these beings. Mythology and legend and all kinds of rumors has it that we repaired this craft, we exchanged candy bars, we communicated.
Exchange candy bars?
One of the many wonderful rumors that has sprung up around this.
Did the aliens have, like, their own candy bar? Or?
Not that I'm aware of,
but
a lot of goofy stuff comes up, I think partly as sort of a nervous way to deal with a very high-stress environment.
Or disinformation.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Rumors to make it sound silly.
Yeah, exactly. But the bottom line was, you know, let's face it, most human communication, from what I understand from classic psychological studies, is nonverbal. It's body language, it's facial expressions, etc.
Right.
In that sense, I guess there was communication per se, but nothing was exchanged, nothing was said. After a while, one of the senior master sergeant on location, Sergeant Ball, started to go around the outside of the circle, and as Larry recalled, tapped like every third guy and sent them back to the staging area. Larry was in the second to last group to head back to that area, which he did, but stopped right where the forest met the field to sort of fix this picture in his mind. The men were immediately admonished not to talk about this, were debriefed the next day in what we both consider, along with many others, a wonderful mix of fact and fiction to create anxiety and fear and kind of overwhelm the men emotionally about what they had seen. And that was the event itself, but the drama really was just beginning in that that night, Larry, Adrian, men who were involved that night and earlier, were subdued chemically, in Larry's case, with an aerosol spray administered by a guy in civilian clothing, and brought into a facility through a long drop in an elevator, a facility that we are convinced exists below that base, and subjected to a certain amount of kind of Disneyland on acid mental programming, mucking about with their thoughts and minds, and then basically turned loose again. Larry, who grew up in an extremely, how can I say, he grew up with a very clear sense of right and wrong instilled in him by his folks, was incensed at the way they had been treated. And I think his feelings were galvanized within a few weeks when one of the guys that had been out there with him that night, a young guy from the South who, from all descriptions, was probably a fundamentalist in his beliefs and overwhelmed emotionally by what he had seen.
I bet you.
Blew his brains out on the tarmac, Larry and a sergeant were the first to respond. And I think that made him into, I guess, what I can describe as an activist, to put it mildly. He was identified early on as a potential troublemaker, and in fact, he was. My co-author left the service with a fully honorable discharge about 6 months later, returned to civilian life with a pretty dramatic case of post-traumatic stress disorder, felt after a year that he could not maintain this secret, connected up with the first UFO investigator that he met, a gentleman named Larry Fawcett, who was co-author of a book called Clear Intent in the 80s about the UFO cover-up. Larry was also, at the time, a Connecticut State Police lieutenant and a heck of an investigator. Mm-hmm. And working with a small group, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, put forward a Freedom of Information Act that resulted, sometime after that, less than a year, in the release of what is certainly the most dramatic document still to be uncovered about this event, a kind of a briefing paper, compressed and a bit toned down, written by the deputy base commander, attesting to the reality of the event, and became very much a public person in this in 1984 and has continued to speak out on it since. That is the barest bone sketch of the incident.
Well, in fact, you did it very well, because we have to go to break right now.
Oh, good.
But don't think I don't have any questions. I'll certainly be back to questions. My goodness, I'm sure that our listeners have questions.
Indeed.
So please stick around, because I need to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. This is the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with Mr. Peter Robbins on the phone today, co-author of Left at East Gate, the Rendlesham Forest Incident. So we're going to be right back with him, so stick around, please. More than 100,000 people in Michigan, 30,000 of which are children. The Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan exists to ensure these individuals and their families receive the resources and support necessary to live normal and productive lives. As the only statewide nonprofit organization that focuses entirely on seizure disorders, the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan enhances lives and changes communities by making it easier for people with epilepsy to live in society. Whether through its programs such as Camp Discovery, Living Well with Epilepsy, or Epilepsy Entertainment Gatherings, the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan sets out each day to act as ambassadors for those coping with this condition. For more information regarding these and other programs, volunteer opportunities, or how to donate, feel free to visit the Foundation's website at www.epilepsymichigan.org. The Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan, not another moment lost to seizures.
For the best in local music, join Motor Thursday afternoons from 4 to 6. The first hour, we feature bands playing around town and encourage you to get out and support live music. At 5 o'clock, we kick out the jams with Motor's Live Drive at 5. Every week, we feature a local band for a full hour live in the studio. So if you want to know what's happening around town and hear some live music, join Motor Thursday afternoons 4 to 6 on WHFR.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
And this is WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. Welcome back to We Are Not Alone. And our special guest, Peter Robbins. Peter, in your book, you admit that Left at East Gate, that is, I better throw that plug out there. In the book, you admit that you started out very skeptical of Larry Warren when he approached you with this book project and this story. And what changed your mind?
Well, I'm not sure if that's really accurate. I was quite impressed by him when I met him, although I felt that he was kind of reckless, courageous, a bit naive. How could he be talking about this stuff in public and not concern for his safety? I heard him do a talk on it a few years later at actually a national MUFON conference in 1987, marking the 40th anniversary of the modern UFO phenomena. And I knew one thing for sure. I wanted to do an in-depth interview with this guy and approached him in the hall the following day. He was very friendly and agreed to do it, and I invited him to New York. He came down to the city from where he was living in Connecticut at the time, literally a week later, and gave me quite the interview of my life. I think I recorded at least 6 hours, and when I finished, he said, "You are free to use this material as you wish. I'm not asking for any fee, just that, you know, you represent me fairly." And I said, "What's the catch here? You've told me things you have never been on record about." He said, "Well, I know you're not the best known person in the field, but I really feel that you are the person that I would like to write this book about my experiences with. You know, I heard you speak, and you seem to know your subject, and are compassionate and decent human being, and work with Bud Hopkins." So he had a bigger ulterior motive, and we began what I would call the armchair phase of research. Basically, I read everything that was written at the time, which wasn't a tremendous amount. He gave me everything he had. And then about 6 months later, we went to England for what I thought would be our only visit. This was a little over 20 years ago. The book originally came out in 97, was republished in an expanded edition in 2005. And that trip quite blew my mind. I came back extremely concerned that I had gotten in over my head. We had had our own multiple UFO incident while we were there. And I know for casual listeners, they may say, "Gee, what a great break for, you know, a writer working on a book about this." And I can only respond, "Think again." We're there on our first trip on the very first night, researching a highly controversial witness, an incident with a highly controversial witness, and we're 5 or 6 miles away, and, you know, I see several dozen UFOs that night. Who's going to believe me? We did record the whole incident as it was happening. I walked around with recorders at the time. So we were off to quite a start.
Yeah.
But, well, yeah, after that, belief almost didn't enter into it. It's like, "Do you believe in chairs?" Yeah, I'm sitting in them. They're real.
Well, if Rendlesham Forest, Woodbridge, that area actually does have an underground base, it would not be out of the question to see UFOs in the air quite often.
Well, that's correct.
Virtually every night, eh?
I am still somewhat equivocal about the nature of this base. Many first and second world militaries have huge underground facilities.
Right.
I think there's more going around going on underground than most of us can even conceive of around the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still feel that this is a very terrestrial base, one that is manufactured and manned by the American military. But again, myth and lore debates that as to whether or not it has an alien presence. The fact is, though, Dave, this part of England, the area in Suffolk, does have a long history of UFO sightings and incidents, as we know some parts of the world do and others don't.
All right. Now, this man that was sobbing that Larry Warren came upon, this gentleman had, was this one and the same that later committed suicide?
No.
Different man.
No, so he had broken down for reasons that, of course, we do not know the particulars of. This was a military situation, and the men were ordered to keep moving, but he was having a breakdown not far from the field where this ground fog was and then where the craft appeared.
So had this gentleman been out further than Larry Warren had at the time out to the field and just came back? And just, you know, is that the reason he was sobbing? He just witnessed something that his mind was not set to take? Or
that's a great question that I'm in no position to answer. Yeah. I'd be speaking basically about something I have no knowledge of. We just know that he was in that location mm-hmm. before Larry got there. It might have been by a matter of minutes, or he might have been out earlier. I just couldn't say.
But the assumption is that he, this gentleman had witnessed something that was highly traumatic.
No.
No?
The assumption is that he was traumatized, whether or not he was just...
he was either traumatized or was homesick at the time. Is that it?
I think it was more than homesick.
But, okay.
Again, there was that electric charge in the air. It was a highly non-standard situation, and mm-hmm. to put it mildly, I'm sure very anxiety-provoking for everyone involved.
I guess. And this poor fellow, that a fundamentalist who committed suicide.
Oh, yes.
Now, isn't this... you know, people say, okay, it was like John Lear comes forward and Coast to Coast and tells you all these terrible things about UFOs and even human mutilations and all the bad things that you can muster about UFOs and the abduction experience. And then at the end of it says, this is why we shouldn't tell the country about UFOs. Well, wait a minute. Didn't you just tell me all the bad things about? Did I miss something? He goes on Coast to Coast Radio to tell you all the details of why you shouldn't tell it. Give me a break. Anyway.
Bless John's heart, yeah.
Yeah, good guy, but I mean, I really have never figured that out. But at any rate, this is the reason, in my opinion, one of the big reasons that the world should at least be officially told this is a real phenomenon. We're not alone in the universe.
Yes.
You know, even if we can't do anything about it, and that's a big deal. They can't do anything. They're not in control.
Indeed.
So they can't tell us. But if at least if we knew, it wouldn't be such a culture shock. You'd be surprised. I get, I'm an investigator for the Mutual UFO Network here in Michigan. And I get so many reports, and I say, I didn't believe in this, but, you know, I was really shaken because they didn't know that these really existed, and now all of a sudden, boom, it's leveled on them. And if they at least had a heads up, yeah, you might see one in your life because they really exist.
I think you've made a wonderful point, Dave, and it's a very delicate point as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we live in a world where most people are kind of sleepwalkers about this.
Mm-hmm.
Reality for them ends at a very different place than it does for anyone that's had an experience like this or seen something that they can't explain. And we're the first to say we don't know what we're dealing with here. I've had readers come up to me and say, so what is the bottom line? What's the truth here? You end your book by saying, this is what you know, this is what you think, this is what you believe, this is what you suspect, this is what you fear. What's really going on? I said, I've told you as much as I know. They're frustrated because I refuse to enter into uninformed speculation or to come to a conclusion based on a series of incidents, facts, allegations that you can't really put together and be definitive about. It's like, you know, handling mercury or smoke. I'm in this 30 years now, and I'm worked as Bud Hopkins' assistant for more than a dozen years. I know that there is another intelligence at work here, probably different permutations of it. I think that we're dealing with, you know, extraterrestrials and probably interdimensionals and maybe time travelers, and who the heck knows? But you know, it's a moot point.
Maybe
we're not
maybe
alone.
All,
and
maybe all of the
should
above
have a basic understanding of that.
Maybe all of the above, huh?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe.
Now, the official explanation to this Rendlesham Forest case was that the airman had mistaken a lighthouse beam for an unconventional flying object. Now, when you were in England, in Rendlesham Forest, did you explore this possibility?
Well, not only did I, I've been back at least 15 times, and I've been out to that particular field dozens of times in all times of year, and at night as well as during the day. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot spookier at night. And I've been there in the dead of winter at night where there's very little coverage of the trees. I'm familiar with the Orford Lighthouse about 8 or 10 miles away. I visited it on the coast. That's a very pretty lighthouse. And if you are standing in that field in the dead of winter at night and you're looking in the right direction and nothing is obstructing your vision, you can see every 15 or whatever, 12 seconds, I forget, a simple pulse of light in the distance coming at you through the trees. To suggest that highly trained military personnel confused this very simple light in the distance with landed craft on the ground is not just idiotic and insulting, it's contemptuous of the truth and almost libelous. The late Phil Klass suggested that some of the men might have been, smoking a joint. This is a nuclear base. If these men have had so much as a beer 12 hours before or taking an over-counter cold medication, they are not allowed to serve on guard duty that night. This was at a time of a red alert. Red is one step below black. Black is war. It's also been suggested that it was a police car, you know, with all of its lights on. It's also been suggested it was a meteor shower. Well, I looked into that as well. In fact, the Royal Observatory, which keeps such records in London, has logged in that on one of those nights, there was a meteor shower. And if you had been standing in the area looking in just the right location at just the right moment with no ambient light, yes, you would have seen meteorites, you know, sweep over your head for 2 to 4 seconds. And that would have been it. So these explanations are absolutely nonsense and almost not worth considering, except that the media, of course, loves to pick up on them and give them back to us.
All right. On UFO Hunters, I'm not going to be able to give you the guys' names now, but UFO Magazine publisher, they went out, maybe you saw that one?
I was actually at the International UFO Congress in Nevada when that aired, so I've yet to see it, but I think I do have some issues with Bill Burns on it, that it was covered.
Bill Burns. Thank you for putting that name in, because I couldn't remember it. I knew it was Bill. Anyway, they went out there, and the guy that ran the lighthouse said that there's this plate in the back of the lighthouse, maybe you saw that, facing the land. The light is supposed to go out over the water, which it does. Mm-hmm. So they put a plate on the back, which had been on the back ever since the lighthouse has been
30-odd years, as I recall.
Yeah.
Well, and again, I only have a friend who called me and tried to describe some of the show to me. I've yet to see it. Again, what I saw in the field in the dead of night in winter was a slight pulse of light in the distance. Had that plate not been there, I probably would have seen a big blast of light, you know, for a second or two, and then as it made its way around again, you know, 360 degrees, seen it repeated at the same time interval.
Right.
So, again, you can make out a pulse those miles away, a bit of light coming through at you at a regular interval, but once again, even that, even if there wasn't anything on it, to see a blast of light every 12 seconds through the trees is very different than seeing a landed object on the ground, or in the case of the men in the first night, a triangular-shaped object moving through the woods at waist height.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
and you can't really see the symbols on the side of a beam of light from the lighthouse, can you?
Not any light that I've seen, and I guess I've seen a few in my life, like every single day since I've been alive, like you.
A skeptic would probably, you know, guys like Magaha, that guy, that you've seen him on Larry King show.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He Well, if you saw that show, you know that he made up all kinds of excuses between Lighthouse and fireballs, and until our friend Jim Peniston said we went up and touched the thing.
Yes.
And it was as good as Magaha saying, "No, I can't explain that, so you must be lying."
Well, that's it. You're either lying or you're deluded or you want to be on the Oprah show or right. You want to write a best-selling book. Right. For me, and I separate people like Magaha from
real people.
Well, from skeptics per se. I hope you're a skeptic. I'm a skeptic.
Yeah.
We have to be.
I know.
If we are not. Uh-huh. We're going to get nailed.
Yeah.
And they are not skeptics. They're professional debunkers.
Right.
And they are, as Bud Hopkins said wonderfully in his talk in Nevada last month, they're the true believers. They know that these things are not real.
Right.
We are not aware of... It's not based on belief for a reasonable investigator. It's based on investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And Magaha comes from the point of view, they're not real. They can't be real. They've never been real. Therefore, people like Larry Warren or Peniston or other first-hand witnesses to UFO incidents are either mischief makers, they're delusional, or they're mentally ill. Mm. Or they've got an angle, you know. They want to be famous.
Right. And most people who have these stories come forward want to remain anonymous.
Oh, not only that. As you know, most of them, the last thing they want to do is be in the public eye. It's just a chance to get ridiculed again. I mean, it's like, it's an extreme example, but it's like somebody who has been... sexually attacked being made fun of for coming forward to report the attack.
Right.
And most of them would like to just live quiet lives, but the fact is some of them feel compelled to tell the truth about something that they or experienced.
When we come back, we're going to explore that a little bit more with Larry in the Larry Warren case, but I need to take a break one more time just to remind our listeners that you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. And we're going to be right back with our special guest, Mr. Peter Robbins. So stick around.
Red Defender! That huge asteroid is headed towards Earth!
I'll handle this.
The Red Defender hurtles towards the asteroid!
You saved us! How?
I stopped the asteroid and reversed it back into space.
The moon! It's exploded!
Where did you throw that asteroid?
Away.
Saving the world isn't easy. Saving a life is. One pint of blood can save up to 3 lives. Go to bloodsaves.com. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Center for Lifelong Learning at Henry Ford Community College offers educational alternatives. Options include upgrading job skills, new career tracks, professional development, continuing education, or personal enrichment. Call to register at 313-317-1500. Classes are affordable. You just might graduate.
Satisfy your Thursday lunchtime cravings on the Blues Time. I'm Mr. White, and I'll cook it up just right with some hot tunes from the smoky bars or out in that greasy garage. Get yourself on the Blues Time Thursday at noon until 2, and you'll be satisfied.
Yeah, the blues here on WHFR. .FM, the only station making waves. I am David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with Mr. Peter Robbins, co-author with Larry Warren of the best-selling book Left at East Gate, the story of the Rendlesham Forest incident. Very, very popular. If you've seen any documentaries on UFOs, I'm sure you've seen... the story of the Rendlesham Forest case. And Mr. Robbins has gone out there and investigated and pretty much verifies what Larry Warren says. Now, Peter, when Larry Warren got back, and we were talking before the break about how most people want to keep their name out of it. They don't want sensationalism or, hey, look at me. If that were the case in Larry Warren's case, he sure made a mistake, as most people do, in that he lost quite a bit by going public with it.
Correct.
Yeah. Am I correct in saying, am I getting too personal here? He lost his wife. Well, it's in the book.
Yes.
He lost his wife. His wife left him. He was threatened. His life was threatened.
Yes.
And isn't it at one point, I was going to ask this before I forget, didn't at one point either CIA, FBI, or Men in Black, or whoever they were, arrange a meet with Larry Warren in a public place and showed him pictures of the landed craft and said pretty much, okay, here it is, you're not crazy, it's real, it really happened, now shut up?
Yes, you're right. There were several meetings that were arranged, and it was specifically with representatives of our super-secret national security agency. Now, I think through abuses in communications and post-9/11 intrusions into our privacy, not to mention a lot of X-Files episodes, a lot of Americans are somewhat familiar with the NSA, but right. At the time, and certainly when we got involved in the work, they were still more the no such agency or never say anything agency. But they are kind of the force here of repression. Mm. The fact is, you've made a very interesting observation. Why did Larry behave the way he did when other guys just tried to get on with their lives?
Right.
And it took me off on a tangent of some months in the course of the 9 years of working and researching this book on the phenomena of what's known in popular culture as whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most famous one in modern times in America is Karen Silkwood, who was an employee of Kerr McGee, a government contractor working in the nuclear industry, who was accidentally or not so accidentally exposed to radiation and followed up with a more lethal dose, and who, quote-unquote, died in a car accident on her way to a clandestine meeting with the New York Times reporter.
Hmm.
But there are many whistleblowers we don't hear about in government and in industry who simply get to the point where, in some way, they feel that what is happening is so wrong that they need to put themselves on the line to address it. And if they take repercussions, that's just the way it goes. And the more I studied it, and there are scientific papers written on folks that take this route, they are a bit different than us. They actually feel that, there's a right and a wrong to things. And if it is wrong enough, it is your responsibility as a citizen to come forward and address it, even at the cost of your peace of mind, safety, or future.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of the definition of my co-author. He is hard-headed. He sees there's a right and a wrong. And, again, he did not break security on this because of something to do with the alien presence. Larry had some non-standard experiences as a younger person, and apparently at least one UFO experience with his mother, who is a very straight-laced, proper Boston Irish Catholic background woman who I would never accuse of stretching the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But in his case, again, I feel he was galvanized, and I think he'd agree, by being one of the first two people to respond to this tragic situation where his colleague had basically put his M16 under his chin and blown the top of his head off on the runway. After seeing the kid suffering and going through some real stuff in this meeting, in this debriefing following the incident the day after, he was actually caught within, I'm trying to remember the time frame, a month or two of the event, when he was waiting in an office starting to go through a file cabinet. He was that compelled to look for stuff.
Hmm.
He did collect accounts to a degree from some of the other men involved who did not want to go forward, and where permissible, those things were included in left at East Gate. But yeah, he is still, I think, somewhat at the effect of this experience, even though it's 28 years now since it happened. And I saw him just a few weeks ago. He came to Nevada. We had a great time. I kind of veered off my planned talk to address the case again, because it is still not going away and still, I think, as important, if not the most important, case of its kind, and one that, if such things were adjudicated in courts of law, this was the one you could win with.
Yeah. I don't think this story is going to go away at all. It's England's Roswell, and like Roswell, 60 years down the road, we're going to be talking about Rendlesham Forest.
I think so.
Yeah, Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. And also in your biography, you mentioned James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, an early casualty of UFO secrecy. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can a little bit. In 1987, many of us in the UFO community got our first awareness of the so-called Eisenhower briefing document, the lead document of the still highly controversial MJ-12. Whether or not this huge collection of documents ultimately proves to be authentic or partially authentic or some extraordinary disinformation job, we will see.
Mm.
I feel that these initial documents, the 8-page briefing document and the 1-page accompanying letter from President Truman to James Forrestal, our first Secretary of Defense, are authentic. And became somewhat obsessed with it, as I did with Rendlesham, and researched it on and off as time and finances would allow for several years before presenting my first paper on it. I've done a number now. And do you have a website, Dave?
WHFR or me personally?
WHFR.
WHFR.fm.
The reason I ask is because if you'd like, I can send you one of the papers that I've done on this for posting online. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, once my research is completed and I've presented it, it's in the public domain, and I think people should educate themselves to it. It's quite complex, and I don't mean to, you know, make it sound, you know, kind of goofy or theatrical or like an X-Files episode that James Forrestal was murdered because he knew too much about UFOs. But the fact of the matter is that this very decent man in public life, what used to be called an old-fashioned patriot, a word that's bandied about with a lot more flexibility these days than then, did a great deal to try to help our government in a time of war, and again was the man who President Truman charged with dismantling our old War Department and creating our modern Department of Defense. But the day that he stepped down in March of 1949, he manifested the presence of a profound nervous breakdown. I'm sure it was quite some time coming. And I am convinced that a contributing factor to this was his helplessness in the face of this unknown threat. He was sworn in September 1947, which is only a matter of 2 months after Roswell. I don't think he was able to do anything to affect or understand the situation better during his tenure, heading up arguably the most powerful defense establishment in the history of the world at that time. And ultimately did try to take his life several times, was institutionalized at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, began to respond to treatment, and I think then, almost on a Greek tragedy level, it was decided high up that he had to die because he had suffered a breakdown. Again, this is 1949, when probably almost no American knew anyone else among their circle of friends or acquaintances who was in what we would call therapy. And this was a tough guy's tough guy. And if it could happen to him, well, who knew? And if he quote-unquote recovered, and then had a relapse or something, who knew what he might blurt out? Mm-hmm. Allegorically, at least, he knew where all the bodies were buried.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating story and one that has been subdued in 20th century American history, but that is just what it's a part of.
Well, now, he allegedly jumped from a 10, 11-story window, is that correct?
It was the 16th floor
16th.
Window, and I think the operative word there is allegedly.
No.
I feel I've been able to put together a case that presents in overwhelming terms that he did not go out that window willingly.
What kind of building was he in when he did go out the window?
Oh, it was the Navy's premier hospital, the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. In Bethesda, Maryland, and he was in, had been up until a few moments before dying, in a secured room with a 24-hour, around-the-clock, three-shift Marine guard at his door.
Was this psychiatric ward?
Yes, oh yes, absolutely.
Okay, now, get the picture here. What they're trying to tell us is Naval hospital, military hospital, psychiatric ward, 16th floor. A patient is in there who is able to get out the window.
Well, no, it's actually even darker than that. His room was fully secured, and his guards knew him, respected and admired him. But on this particular night, early the morning of May 22nd, 1949, his normal guard did not show up. We're told that he was drunk. Well, this was a young man who was a Marine devoted to Forrestal, with no history of improper behavior.
Mm.
And we get a hospital orderly assigned to the room guard that night. He checks the room at 1:30. Forrestal seems to be sleeping, checks 10 minutes later. He's up, asks him if he wants anything. The secretary says no. He leaves and then remembers he might have forgotten to lock the door. Goes back, the room is allegedly empty, a search is commenced, and we're supposed to believe that Forrestal, in that moment, and not only do all of his hospital records indicate that he was becoming well at such a rate that he was quite close to discharge, friends such as his closest confidants, the President of the United States, his brother, the second Secretary of Defense, all attested to the fact that he was looking better, sounding better, much more upbeat, much more life positive, that in that moment he suffered a total relapse, became suicidally depressed, walked out the open door across the hall, took the sash off of his bathrobe, tied it to the radiator below the window, which was later dismissed as nonsense by the military, then tied the other end of it around his neck, double knotted it, lowered himself out of the window, changed his mind, and then the sash cord let go. We now know, and this is an absolute fact from the investigation after, that the other end of that cord was not tied to anything, and that in doing my research on this with consulting with numerous mental health professionals specializing in suicide, as one psychologist said to me, jumpers jump, and people who want to hang themselves, hang themselves. I've never heard of a case where somebody tried to hang themselves out of a high window.
Jeez.
And there's more to it. That's just the tip of the iceberg. He was murdered. He was murdered, and I believe that the concern that he might blurt something out about what he knew about this situation, if he had a relapse, if he was discharged from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
As they say in the mafia, it's nothing personal. It's just business.
It's
the
just
man
business.
Had
That's
to
right.
die.
Yeah. Peter Robbins, where can we learn more about Left at Eastgate?
You can go online to any bookseller, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and order the book. It's published by Cosimo, C-O-S-I-M-O Press, Left at Eastgate, and it's Larry Warren and myself are the authors, and you can order it online from wherever you are.
Okay. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we are not alone tonight, today, and this is going to be aired in the morning.
Oh, terrific.
So, for Saturday of May. So, once again, thank you very much for joining us. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Well, me too, Dave. Let's plan on it.
Okay, good enough. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And please visit my website at ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now being archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Archives of the Weekly weekly WHFR Forum. And stay tuned to WHFR for the best in alternative music. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. when we will again be exploring the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning. My name is Bill Keith, and it is a pleasure to be here with you. I've got a lot of great music lined up. I'm excited about new music from Jeff Coffin and Charlie Peacock, a pretty interesting jazz collaboration that we'll dig into a little bit later in the show. Also have new music from The Waifs, The Weepies, Hayes Carroll, The Wood Brothers. Oh, boy, just a whole lot more. The Black Keys. Plus, we can get to your requests at 313-845-9676. This next group I wasn't familiar with until the last month or so. And then we got their CD here at the station, and I have just really enjoyed everything I've heard from it. Here's a song from Virginia Coalition. This is called Santa Fe. You're listening to 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're proud to be making waves.